listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2014 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud. At times, reading Richard Powers' new novel, Orfeo, a brilliant weaving of science, art, and literature, I was literally jolted out of my seat by his images. I had to put the book down and go find a willing listener, which is usually my husband, to whom I could read a sentence like this one. Quote, "And then the finale, its four modest notes, do, re, fa, mi, half a jumbled scale, too simple to be called invented, but the thing spills out into the world like one of those African antelopes that fall from the womb, still wet with afterbirth, but already running." Which also struck me as a great metaphor for Richard Powers' work, for his ideas, which are woven into the fabric of his narrative. They hit the ground running. The protagonist of Orfeo is Peter Ells, a 70-year-old composer who maintains a do-it-yourself genetics lab in his suburban Pennsylvania tract house. It's a hobbyist's genetic engineering project aimed at finding musical patterns in DNA strands. So what is it that the two gents from the Joint Security Task Force don't understand when they come to Peter's door? They layer sinister intent onto the artist's insights into music and science. After his misunderstanding with the two agents, Peter Ells goes on the run, revisiting his past and earning the nickname Bioterrorist Bach. And I won't tell you more because I want you to hear it from the author himself. And after you hear him, I'm pretty sure you will want to read this extraordinary novel for yourself, and you might well need to stop and read sections out loud to a willing listener. I hope you have one. As critic David Eula noted in the LA Times, Richard Powers has been writing disruptive fiction for over 30 years. He is the author of 11 novels. His 2003 book, The Time of Our Singing, was a finalist for the National Book Award, and his 2006 novel, The Echo Maker, was a National Book Award winner. He's a native of Evanston, Illinois, and also spent part of his childhood in Bangkok, where his father ran an international school. He studied physics and literature at the University of Illinois, and in his spare time taught himself computer programming. Powers is a recipient of the MacArthur Fellowship and the Lannan Literary Award, among many other honors. He's recently accepted a teaching position at Stanford University, so we have him here on the West Coast, and we're thrilled to welcome him for the first time to the Aloud series. And of course, in conversation with Richard tonight, you know Michael Silverblatt. Many of you know him from his wonderful show, KCRW's regular radio show, Bookworm, where Michael introduces listeners to new and emerging authors along with writers of renown. He's interviewed many of the authors here on stage for our series over the years, Michael Frayn, Marilyn Robinson, Joyce Carol Oates, and all those readers would tell me afterwards no one else read them as thoroughly and as deeply as Michael Silverblatt. Steve Erickson, another wonderful novelist, refers to Michael as our reader laureate, which I think is an apt description. Please join me in welcoming Richard Powers and Michael Silverblatt to the LA Public Library.
Good evening. Thank you for coming on such an auspicious evening. I know that, is it called Tebow, will make it possible to hear the State of the Union Address, but in a way, a novel is a State of the Union Address, and certainly this novel, Orfeo, by Richard Powers, talks about not only what has happened to art in our time, to music in our time, to science in our time, but to, you know, human destiny, the nature of the human. I think at a certain point, it was basically announced, a series of announcements were made. There was the death of the author, followed by the death of the human. The idea was that humans would no longer be at the center of their universe, machines would be. And very soon thereafter, machines arrived. And we have every reason to doubt that we are at the center of the human universe. This book worries about that in a profound and beautiful way. The hero is 71 years old. To what extent is his perspective? His name is Peter Else. To what extent is his perspective the perspective of age?
Well, I think we're all products of our moment. Else is born in 1940. And that, of course, is a time of great transition for this country. And it's a time of great transition for music in this country. His personal journey is one that finds him in childhood obsessed with finding patterns, making patterns, decoding patterns. He can do this with great skill across what's traditionally seen as this unbridgeable divide, which is not neither unbridgeable nor really a divide. He has skill in mathematics and also in music. That's a correlation that I think is pretty time-honored. Because he is born at that particular moment, back to your question about how much is he a product of his time, he has inherited a world, a musical world, and a cultural world that is still intact. He has not crossed over yet into that that break that happens later in the century. And he's still very much a product of a kind of late Romanticism. His tastes in music tend toward legacy and preservation and continuity. But by the time he's a young man in his 20s and studying music professionally, he, of course, enters into that that maelstrom that has elected for a different relationship to art, and one in which you must make it new, you must break the past, and you must find some way to push the vocabulary of your art into new and strange and unheard, as yet unheard places.
Yes, it's a progression that you and I have lived through. We're more or less coevals, mm-hmm. I think.
And he would be roughly a generation older than us, so he's experiencing that at a different time.
Right. And, you know, that... Do you have it? I have it. Do you have it? The feeling that the end of the world is upon us. And the end of the novel, the end of things we love, the end of music, the end of intelligent children, the end of... You know, I wake up worried, and the book helped me understand why, because he points out that dread and terror are, you know, of the essence. They are our stock and trade right now. It's how we are owned in a certain sense, and we find ourselves struggling in
so
it.
Let me make that jump from this, you know, from this original crisis that he faces as a young man. You know, in music, this is often characterized the great 20th century oath of allegiance, whose side are you on, took the form of Schoenberg or Stravinsky, right? Do you want to launch yourself outward onto an entirely new language, one that that looks upon the past as quaint and archaic? Or do you want to somehow look back to the past and try to continue that legacy and reinvent it for this moment? So Else elects for the former. Right? He casts his lot in with the avant-garde, and he spends the rest of his life struggling with fear of culture. He chooses to commit to an art that's strange, that's thorny, that's scary, dangerous. And not surprisingly, he ends up spending a life of concerts where there are more and more people on stage and fewer people in the audience. And this, of course, mirrors the crisis of concert music in this country and in Europe in the 20th century. But what Michael's alluding to is that as he pursues this vision of a radical art, a transgressive or a dangerous art, deeper and deeper into the outer reaches of what the ear might be able to hear, he hits on this idea ultimately of what he sees as a great farewell gesture, I guess, to the avant-garde, his final conceptual piece, in which he will convert a piece of his composition into a base four code, the way we convert music into binary and for digital recording, get a mail order, online mail order house to convert that into a nucleotide string, and see if he can't teach himself enough genetic engineering to insert that string into a bacterium, which is then going to propagate throughout the world, and this will be the ultimate avant-garde piece. It will be everywhere, all around you, and you won't be able to hear it. Right? This, of course, as Louise gave the summary and Michael has reiterated, brings him his first real audience. At first, Homeland Security. Of course, we now know those guys will listen to anybody, right? But then a panicked country, right? A country that doesn't understand what an artist might be trying to do with this. And immediately, you know, the most available explanation is this has to be what we've always feared, right? I would say, okay, so here's a guy who's wrestled with fear of culture his whole life and is finally smacking up against the culture of fear. If I were giving the State of the Union address, I would say the State of the Union is still scared, and we have been for a long time.
I think that one of the things that this book traces, interestingly, in the character of Peter Ells, is the movement from the brilliant romantic hero, whether that's Liszt, who caused people to faint at his concerts, or Dickens, ditto, people fainted at his readings, Byron. The writer-artist was seen always as a kind of species of terrorist. We've moved through the Romantic movement to a different definition of terrorism. And so now Peter Ells finds himself at what will be the end of his life, most likely, making that step from the artist as hero, Stravinsky style, Joyce style, Beckett style even, to the artist as terrorist, whose work will depend on being misunderstood. Yes? In a certain way, his name will be known in proportion to the degree that his work is misunderstood.
Yeah.
If you understand it, you can understand it. It's an interesting idea that a germ cell could become a time capsule for music, preserve all kinds of music. We would no longer have to send these things out in satellites or bury them in Yosemite.
Yeah, in fact, I should say, while this book was going into production and I was proofing galley pages, I read about a bioinformatics group in Britain that commissioned that converted a few short PDFs, an audio file of Martin Luther King giving his speech, converted all these into base four, mail ordered. I mean, it was the book recreated. You know, found a California outfit that would turn this into nucleotide strings, sent it across the world where they sequenced it and extracted the information back again using DNA as a storage medium. The other thing that happened while I was working on the book, I mean, it's not giving anything away to say that this book is based in part on the 2004 story of another artist, Steve Kurtz, the bio artist and provocateur, whose work had been shown in exhibitions and museums not only all over the country but internationally, who in 2004, you know, 3 years after the attacks, was arrested for having materials in his house. And despite the fact that he could show very, very rapidly within the space of an hour or two that these materials were in preparation for an upcoming exhibition at a major museum, was held and was not completely exonerated. Charges were not entirely dropped for another 4 years. Okay. So that's the germ of this story. And I just thought, what if I convert this into an artist whose use is even more ambiguous?
And I want to add to what Richard just said. You see, we've made a culture in which this kind of thing is required. I once met with a bunch of NPR, because I'm, you know, National Public Radio, KCRW, and I went to a conference, and the people in arts coverage were explaining to me, it's horrible, that the art story that day had to be as strong or stronger than the story about Afghanistan. Mm. That it wasn't just there would be an art story every day. You know, so I started saying the things that we humanists do say. That men die every day for lack of what is found there. Mm. And if you don't believe that, you shouldn't be an arts reporter. And if you are working at a desk that is throwing out the art stories because of the importance of the Afghanistan story, quit the job. Quit en masse. We need our culture. We continue to need it. We will need it for as long as there are people. And what did they say to me? They said, well, you're lucky to be working at KCRW. You can't give up a job that easily. But the thing that I particularly remember them saying is, oh, well, there is an art story that will get run. Ah, I thought. Yes, they said, artists who are making paintings with AIDS-infected blood, that story will run. Mm. So in other words, it became a requirement for a story to run for art to be a species of bioterrorism. Mm. Yes?
Yeah. You know, as I was working on this book, I had real doubts about whether this basic plot would seem completely outlandish, and whether, I mean, once he decides, you know, he makes this initial kind of naive inference, you know, his house has been raided, he's not in it at the time by accident. And now he has the choice of whether to turn himself in and clear everything up, or, and this is what he finally elects for, wait a moment, give it a day or two, doesn't have to deal with the handcuff part and the cell part. And they'll see very quickly that the stuff that he's working with is benign and that he couldn't possibly be, and that he's broken no laws. Nothing that hundreds, maybe thousands of do-it-yourself biology hobbyists and practitioners are doing all over the country. Of course, making that choice is an escalation of the basic confrontation. But as he goes on the run, he begins to realize that everything he does is leaving an endlessly dense data trail. Right? He can't do anything. He can't run his credit card through a gas pump. He can't turn his cell phone on. Right? He can't check into a motel without standing in front of a security camera. He can't use an ATM. And this notion that somehow his whole life has become this documented conceptual artwork that's being amassed and possibly scrutinized becomes a meditation as he goes through this classic American road fugitive novel toward the West. And while he's working on this, he's thinking, you know, are people going to think that this is you know, hyperbolic? And you know, maybe Kurtz, because that was fairly close to the you know to the attacks, and you know this notion that somehow placing a call is going to have you know bring the SWAT team down from the helicopters. And as I was going into the final passes, I thought, you know, maybe I should just step that back a little bit. And then the Snowden story broke, and I wanted to go back in and say, no, I've got to juke this up now. You know, I'm going to run with this. Yeah, it was a little late for that, but it's amazing. And it just keeps coming. And I don't think we've seen even, you know, even a quarter of what we're still to hear. I mean, the story, front page story on the Times today is the leaky apps. That while you're playing Angry Birds, they're collecting your data, your geolocation and your name and your Facebook contacts. And you know.
Well, and he does, you see, read in another way, this is a tender-hearted guy.
Mm, yeah, a
very
naive
emotional,
guy, an artist.
Very impassioned. Yeah. And I thought we'd ask to read a couple of pages from the beginning where what has happened, what's brought this all down, as Paul Bowles might say, is... his dog has died. His dog has had a seizure. The dog is trembling, so Peter Ells dials 911 to get someone over to help him hold the dog so that the dog can be brought to the vet, to the hospital. Mm-hmm. The dog dies. The 911 people arrive, very interested in the peculiar musical instruments around, but what's in that room over there? Oh, a laboratory, you see. And this has not been, you know, he's a private man. He's something of a recluse. His life has led him to more and more private behavior. He's a teacher. So here we see him in a moment as he is burying his dog. The dog has been given to him by his daughter, Sarah.
That's right.
It's being buried in a quilt that was given to him by his ex-wife. And here he is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I should say, they tell him, call animal control. You're not allowed to bury the dog. But the dog liked the backyard. And this is a choice that's going to have repercussions down the line, too. He went out to the backyard with a flashlight, a shovel, and a lump wrapped in a quilt. He picked a spot by a line of boxwoods that Fidelio had loved to mark. Already, the little plot was covered over with a dense mat of weed species. Life traded in a profligate overkill that never failed to stun him. Els set the flashlight into the crook of a honeysuckle, took up the shovel, and dug. The thump of his sole on the rung and the snick of the shovel whiffing into the stony earth set a calming two-step. When the hole was deep enough to hold the companion of his late years, he put down the shovel and picked up the body. Fidelio now felt light, like something had left her in the hour and a half since she'd died. He stood on the edge of the hole, considering the quilt. His ex-wife had made it from their spent clothes more than 40 years ago, in the happiest stretch of their shared years. The quilt was large and luminous, in deep shades of cerulean, jade, emerald, and chartreuse. The pattern was called Night in the Forest, and Maddie had taken almost 2 years to complete it. Alongside the set of cloud chamber bowls, it was the finest thing Els owned. Sanity demanded that he salvage, clean, and leave it on a shelf for his daughter to find when he died. But Fidelio had died in this quilt, the most uncomprehending of deaths, comforted only by the familiar coverlet. If humans had a soul, surely this creature did. And if humans did not, then no gesture here was too fine or too ridiculous. Els apologized to Maddie, whom he hadn't seen in decades, and placed the bundle into the earth. The quilt-wrapped corpse nestled in the pit of loam. By the flashlight's glow, night in the forest glistened in rich, cool tones. For a moment, those dark greens redeemed all the pain that he and Maddie had ever inflicted on each other. Humming to himself a slowly unfolding upward phrase, Else picked up the shovel again. 6 times in the course of his 7 decades, he'd been forced to remember how grief made you love the smallest, most mistaken thing. This was the 7th. A voice said, "What are you doing?" Else gasped and dropped the shovel. Startled by that startle, the voice called out, "It's me." Standing on a lawn chair, the neighbor's 8-year-old peeked out over the slats of the wooden fence. 8-year-old children wandering around unsupervised in the middle of the night. Else couldn't remember the boy's name. Like all boys' names in the age of social networking, it began with a J. "What's that?" Jay asked in a silky whisper. "I'm burying my dog." "In that?" "It's like a grave offering." Jay knew all about grave offerings from multiplayer online games. "You can bury them in your yard?" "She liked it back here. Nobody has to know, right?" "Can I see it?" "No," Elle said. "She's peaceful now." Els picked up the shovel and scooped dirt into the hole. Jay watched, rabid with interest. He'd seen several thousand deaths already in his young life, but a careful burial was the wildest novelty. The hole became a modest mound. Els stood over it, looking for the next step in this ad hoc service. She was a good dog, Fidelio. Very smart. "Fidelio? Her name. That's long for Fido or something?" This dog could sing. This dog could tell pretty chords from harsh ones. Else didn't mention that she preferred the harsh ones. Jay looked suspicious. "What did she sing?" "Everything. She was very broad-minded." Else took the flashlight and waved it toward the fence. "You think we should try to sing something for her?" Jay shook his head. "I don't know any sad songs, except for the funny ones."
I didn't bring my tissues. You see, it's a tender novel, and it asks a question, you know, that we're all facing. In order to write a tender novel and have readers, do you have to bring it to the point of terrorism? You're asking the same question implicitly about the novel that you're asking in the novel about music. How far does it have to go in order still to have an audience?
Yeah, that's very interesting. I mean, I'm kind of thinking about this relationship for the first time. The question, whose side are you on? Are you gonna ask people to go where they don't want to go? And how far are you going to ask them to go? I mean, that is strongly related to the other very common Kunstler-Roman question that really infuses this book, which is, what price are you willing to pay to try to create this transcendent thing? You know, your wife, your daughter. So those traditional questions of what price accomplishment are very much part of the forward motion of the book.
And part of the formal scheme of the novel, you'll pardon me because I love formal schemes.
Me too.
is that there's a series almost of essays, lectures on music. Mm-hmm. The first one, if I'm not mistaken, is a description of Mahler,
right,
of the Kindertotenlieder. Eventually, at an old age home, there'll be a description of how Messiaen wrote the music for the end of time in concentration camp-like circumstances. In other words, the joining of intellect and sadness,
yeah,
is very meaningful to the book. It's like, don't you start with me, says Richard Powers, calling me a cold intellectual.
Oh, but I am. I am. I love ideas more than I love people. No, the point is, if you're gonna write a book whose forward in motion depends upon this question, whose side are you on? You know, what are you going to try to ask your audience to do? How much are you willing to pay in your personal life? You have to hear the world the way this guy hears the world. So to understand this 71-year-old guy, I had to go back and look at these, you know, these landmarks, these rallying points, or let's say these hills that the composers of the 20th century fought and died on, and to go back and hear music that sometimes was familiar to me, sometimes was brand new, and listen to it again, not as a landmark, but as a very uncertain and contingent and troubling thing. And to hear it the way Else would have heard it as a young man, or to hear it the way, you know, the German officer sitting in the front row of this unheated barrack in 1941 are hearing, you know, Messiaen and his three fellow prisoners, you know, three other fellow prisoners playing on these beaten-up instruments, you know, this music from outer space. Try to make it again a dramatic thing, you know, something where somebody said, the world is urgent, and here's how I hear it.
Now, out of the depths of a memory that doesn't let anything go, I remembered that 13 years ago, you know, it really is terrible to start to cry on stage.
I say bring it on.
Okay. Richard and I were in Santa Fe. He was giving a reading with David Foster Wallace, who was a dear friend of both of ours. You know, the life of an artist is not a trivial thing, and the life of a work of art is not either. Our hosts, the Lannan Foundation, people to whom I owe much of my life, arranged for us to go to a think tank. What was the name of
that? The Santa Fe Institute, this famous Institute for Complexity.
It's where, you know, Cormac McCarthy hangs out a lot now. And I remembered, because this goddamn library asked me to write a blog about what Richard and I would talk about. So I thought, what will we talk about? We'll talk about this morning in the think tank and about what a thriving intellect Richard Powers is, while I was glassy-eyed and uncomprehending, and David was doing his best, you know, to not show what he was feeling. And what were they talking about? Then this morning, 13 years ago, they were talking about penetrating the nucleus of the cell. And I realized, well, the germination point, if you will, of this book took place before my very eyes.
Yeah.
And, you know, that, well, writers, just as I didn't remember remembering it, you probably didn't remember it either. It becomes part.
That's right.
Memory is our DNA.
Yeah, that's to me, a great reminder once again of the long gestation of things like this. That you get that initial spark, and it sits for a decade. You know, that chronology, let's see. So actually, I think that was 2000. So the next year, everything changes. Right? 2004, Kurtz is arrested, released in 2008. 2010, I have a first visiting appointment at Stanford, where because of a dear friend and a fellow MacArthur fellow, I get a job as a lab assistant in a biochemistry laboratory and assist in a large scale gene screen, and begin reading Alex Ross's great book, The Rest Is Noise, a history of the 20th century music told as the most dramatic story. And suddenly these things that have been sitting for a decade or more are there. And it's not like I saw the entire story, but I saw enough of it to start going.
It's amazing. I'm curious, you know, like as a fillet here, totally out of the blue, what kind of a child were you?
I was fourth of five kids, growing up on the north side of Chicago. The first four of us were just rapid fire, boom, 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 you know, assembly line baby boomer stuff. And my little brother was a couple years, you know, 3 years younger than me, 4 years younger. Kind of a child was I. My mother says that at 3 or 4 years old, I would try to take the dish towel from her and dry the dishes for her because I felt sorry for her. That was her characterization of me as a child. So maybe that's, you know, that's the novelist too. You know, you're trying somehow to create a world that makes more sense or is more livable or somehow spares people the worst. The problem is the books keep ending up darker than I anticipate. But maybe that's, you know, that may be part of the adaptive advantage of story too. You know, you go into that darkness where there's a safety net, you know, and you can stare that down and live with your worst fears, you know, so that when you close the last page, you've got a little repertoire that you didn't have going in.
And it's all going on simultaneously. You see, in this novel, there are cycles, visitations, returns to the past. Mm-hmm. It does have the shape of a piece of modern music. Mm-hmm. And what are sometimes songs of joy become elegies. Mm-hmm. It's rather remarkable how this book is structured, and structure and coincidence are sisters. Mm. Speaking of sisters, do you happen to have two sisters named Patty and Peggy?
Uh-oh. I'm in trouble. Yeah.
I was reading this book in a restaurant, and the waiter came over to me and said, "Oh, you're reading a Richard Powers book. I went to school with his sisters, Patty and Peggy, and I haven't been able to find them. We knew each other very well. I don't know how to reach them. Will you ask
them? Oh, my God.
The girls were P's and the boys were R's.
That's correct.
There were five of them. And I thought, as I continued to read this book, I thought, this waiter is going to appear in this book any second. I mean, you know, here's the note.
That is amazing. Oh, good Lord. Extraordinary.
I mean, because if I was there when this novel was born, why shouldn't the waiter have been there? You know, like, we are part of a systematic structure of meaning that is beyond us.
I'm a believer. Wow. That's extraordinary.
Well, you see, part of the art of interviewing, the real art of interviewing, there has to be surprises.
Well, you've timed that one very nicely, I have to say.
I didn't tell him when I saw him this afternoon, And he thought that the only surprise I had up my sleeve was the story of the think tank. Oh, no! A bookworm is a full-time worker. You really have to do your job. That's and make it pleasurable for everyone. You know, just as the book is, by the way. This is one terrific, terrific book. I had a very, very good time with it. Because it is playing with something that I'm always asking. Does a book now, in order to be attended to, does it need to become a thriller?
Yeah.
This book keeps becoming a thriller and then becoming something else.
It is the quietest thriller in the world. Yeah. The fastest car chase occurs at 35 miles an hour. Adam Johnson... colleague of mine at Stanford, Orphan Master's Son, the author of that magnificent book, said, you know, to me, he said, you know, when writers write about music, they're really writing about writing. And I guess that's very true to some extent. And this question, how far can you ask your readers to go, is the question that all of us are asking, We do want to push the language forward and the form forward and make it new, but very, very conscious of how difficult that is to do in an age that has strongly decided that certain turns of the avant-garde novel were wrong. Right? So how do you redeem the best of what broad readerships are repudiating and still have enough seduction there to bring people into a story that isn't particularly well behaved, or that who was it? Randall Jarrell said a novel is a long piece of prose with something wrong with it. Right? How can you put as many wrong notes as possible into the book and yet still bring a reader through to the last page? That's a real crisis, and I've taken different tacks at different times with different books, but in some ways the great pleasure of writing this book for me was just kind of finding a freedom to create something that's neither fish nor fowl. I mean, it has a human component to it. It also makes you read 18 pages about the composition of Messiaen's Quartet for the End of Time. You know, it's a book. You know, John Fowle says that all novels, in a way, are an exercise in finding freedom, and that's what this book was for me. Yeah.
Now, a question, because I think we have to all ask it in order to answer it. Was there a mistake in the avant-garde novel, in the avant-garde music, in the avant-garde art? Do we, are we in some way... My teacher, John Barth, who was, like a father to me, he used to say, I want the most modern novel I can have and still tell the best story that can be told. Mm-hmm. I want both. You can't have one without the other. Yeah. You're giving up too much if you give up narrative. Mm-hmm. What do you think?
Well, Barth was a great landmark and inspiration for me as well. And I guess if we convert that, you have to choose between Schoenberg and Stravinsky. I mean, what would it be for us? You'd have to choose between Barth or Gass on the one hand, and who, John Gardner or something on the other hand. You know, that sense of bifurcation in those years where you either elect for just tell a story and get out of the way, to actually the human story is much more complicated and interesting than you think, and we need new forms and new language to open up that story above and below the eye level view. That's a great crisis. Now, what's interesting with Els is that he starts out as this young post-romantic. He's disabused of that. He becomes thorny. He commits himself to this rigorous style. He relaxes and opens up in his adulthood and in his middle age into a more eclectic style, rediscovers older languages, finds ways of regenerating them, and then at the end of his life stops writing altogether. But at the very end, after this fugitive story is set in motion, a series of crises force him to want to go and see what kind of redemption he can make for the life that he's lived. And again, to find some kind of last way of turning this horrible misunderstanding into an artwork that might somehow be redemptive, however terrifying or however horrible. And he has an occasion on the day in which he is about to, well, I won't give this away, but let's just say music comes to him in the form of Peter Lieberson's Neruda sonnets, Neruda songs. Lieberson being himself a deeply committed, serial, thorny composer as a young man, goes on record later as saying he wanted to apologize to his students as leading them astray, right, and writes this set of songs, you know, for his wife who would die shortly thereafter, love songs, you know, that sound more romantic than the Mahler Kindertotenlieder that opens the century, right? So the revolution's been swept away, and here he is. You know, do you admit defeat? Do you wave the white flag and say yes? And part of Elsa's saying, maybe there are worse things in the world than to have written a tune that everybody likes. You know, he says, but no, I did want something. I wanted something deeper, stranger, more serious, something that compelled a listening outside of a comfort zone, and that's where I'm going to go. Right. And I have always wanted to have it both ways, like Barth, you know, somehow to create a work that is difficult and demanding and disturbing, but also recognizably human. But the point is, what we think of as human is a much bigger story than we thought, and is getting bigger all the time. In every kind of magnification. And that's ultimately what I've wanted to do. Not to replace the basic human dramas of who's up and who's down and who is in and out, who's out and who gets to marry whom, but to add to those dramas, the ones that we've been selected to understand, the eye-level passion of being a human, choosing and making mistakes, add to that everything that we've learned about the astronomical odds about our being here, right? Against our being here, and add to that a sense of this enormous increased capacity to change the laws of time and space, you know, and put that into the story too, because that's us as well.
Right? Now, before we turn to the audience, the readers, our friends, for questions, I want to bring in a subject that we haven't addressed, but I think it may be significant. I read that you speak your novels.
Sometimes. I also handwrite them and have my handwriting converted to text. I also type. I think it's nice to have multiple ways of making words, depending on what the passage, the individual passage in the book is calling out for.
Okay. Right. Because the way I heard it, it sounded like you were speaking to the computer, which was textualizing mm-hmm. it, and I was wondering...
I do a fair amount of that, yeah. I have done.
And when the computer makes a mistake, when it doesn't understand you,
yeah.
Do you find a way to incorporate it, or do you correct it?
You know, and again, Else's path crosses... Cage, you know, who is of course the seminal figure of mid-century American music in so many ways, and Cage's great lesson, of course, is that noise, you know, and chance are music's maiden name, you know, and if we give up our sense of what of how much order and how much pattern and how much structure we need in order to make music worth listening to, worth focusing on and concentrating on, we realize that there is a whole lot more in the world that we can hear, right? And so, yeah, paying attention to chance, I'm not ashamed to do it. I'll find the next word or phrase in any kind of serendipitous occasion that will present itself.
You see, I imagine this novel, Orfeo, being murmured. That it's such a soft voice in it, and it's so often all those great words, crepuscular, twilight, you know, all those things. Now, let's see. Raise your hand if you have a question, and a microphone will come to you. We did it again.
That's great.
No, here's a new one. We have an infinite number of microphones.
Presto. Okay, a question for both of you. Mr. Silverblatt, assuming that, and it's a big assumption, that we can produce a computer program or a descendant of a computer program that can produce art, that it would be defined by us as intelligent the way Turing would define intelligent. Would you greet that artwork with fear or with joy? And for Mr. Powers, do you think that if we do achieve the ability to create intelligence, that that will come more from the computer side or more from the genetic experimentation side of manipulating chromosomal information?
Can I answer his question?
I'll try. I feel, this was a question that another of my teachers would have been thrilled to answer. That was Hugh Kenner, and he was one of the people who really was interested in Turing. And in fact, he read Gulliver's Travels ultimately as a Turing test. Is this human? How do you determine what is human? And he said that we were intuiting these problems within the human from the 18th century, that Jonathan Swift knew about them. So these questions are part of an ongoing investigation. I happen to like literature and music created by random processes. I would want to, as a human, judge on an individual case. I love some of Cage's pieces, in particular one that he did with his lover, Merce Cunningham, that depended upon a music track of sounds that he recorded in locations that appear in James Joyce's Finnegan's Wake. It doesn't make pretty music, but somehow the dancing, in this case, jigs, were incorporated into Cunningham's concept. It was beautiful. I love some of the writing done by the Ulipo writers who choose, say, to write a novel without the letter E and see what its subject becomes. In this case, the human truth is that the writer was Georges Perec. His name has four E's in it, so he couldn't include his own name in his novel. But more importantly, his parents had died. The Nazis had disappeared them. And this impulse to write a novel without E's was, for him, he said it, the same as the impulse randomly to create a world without Jews. And the result of the novel without E's is that the author is no longer a part of it, no longer privy to his own creation. If a computer wrote the novel, would I be less interested? If it were a good novel, I wouldn't care if my sister wrote it. You know, that really is me. I'll read it, you know, I'll read it. And if I'm, you know, like, then I'd want to read other novels by that computer. You know, not any computer, but there might be one that would be a good writer.
That's terrific. That's terrific. As for fear, in time of our singing, I make one of my protagonists, who is decides to head out into the middle of a riot that seems to eternally recur over the course of his lifetime, wearing a T-shirt that I myself acquired from the Museum of Contemporary Art in Chicago that says "Fear No Art." All right. My question was whether an artificial intelligence is more likely to be something programmed in nature versus something biological in nature. Yeah. Yeah.
Either genetically or computation.
Yeah. Well, and that line becomes more and more tenuous, right, as we go forward in our various technologies. And there are kinds of convergences that blur this difference between, you know, computation and physiology, right? There's also this moving goalpost of intelligence. I mean, we have created all kinds of things that would have satisfied that definition, you know, in previous generations of reflection on that question. And what, of course, is happening is we're becoming much, much, much more aware of the way in which anything that we call intelligence is a highly hybridized and highly prosthetic combination of things. There are no brains in vats, there are only brains in bodies, but there are also bodies only in social groups with, you know, and using all these tools that are extensions of our capacity to create representations and imaginative projections. So yeah, intelligence, you know, has to increasingly be seen as a tangled reciprocal networks of all these kinds of different agents.
This is the same way he was at that think tank. He just dazzles me. I mean, he does. He takes my breath away. Yeah. That's wonderfully put. Another question.
For Mr. Bowers, I was wondering, as you look into mathematics and science in literature, do you find that there's a more tenuous separation between literature and science fiction going forward?
Not just science fiction. I really am committed to this idea that same search for meaningful pattern and surprise inside what seems to be predictable pattern is driving all of us forward, whatever disciplines we're attached to. Right? Actually, there's a beautiful passage in an essay by Lewis Thomas, who is one of the great refutations of the two-culture divide, right? A doctor and a researcher and one of the most beautiful writers you'll ever find. And the essay is called On Matters of Doubt. And he says, you know, I need to find a common foundation that will unite all disciplines, whether it's geophysics or biochemistry or archaeology or, you know, textual hermeneutics, and I think I've found one. It's called bewilderment. Right?
I just wanted to ask a quick comparative literature kind of question, just because I don't feel that, Mr. Powers, that you have a lot of analogs in contemporary writing in terms of conceptual or speculative fiction, but one guy that on the other side of the pond, I think of when I read your stuff, and I know Michael's interviewed him, is David Mitchell.
Oh,
and I
yeah.
just wanted to know if you had any thoughts or if you view yourself as an influence on him or vice versa, or if either of you could speak to his writing as it relates to yours.
I would trade, you know, any four of mine to have done one of his. No, he's amazing. He's really a phenomenon. Yeah. Do you want to add something to that?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
I was told the 2 days before I was to meet David Mitchell that I would find him angelic, and I did. Mm-hmm. I mean, he is a remarkable human presence. As is our friend here, as was David Wallace. Mm. And I always feel that these presences in the world are jeopardized by their very nature. They are visitors here. I think David Mitchell's work is extraordinary. I can't wait for his next
book. Yeah, there's a new one.
Book. Mm. I collect old wooden jigsaw puzzles that had, I don't know if any of you remember them, but they were hand-caught. They had, in the sky, are pieces shaped like birds. Next to the bird, underneath, might be a piece shaped like the letter B for bird. The interrelationship of the piece and the picture it's in is very complicated. Nabokov would have loved them. What's his name? The Changing Light of Sandover, that poet.
James Merrill.
Yeah. Wrote a poem called Lost in Translation about these puzzles. So I wanted to give David Mitchell something the second time I saw him. And he said, you know, because I lived in Japan for so long, I could only accept such a gift if I could give something of equal impressiveness back. And I can't think of anything. May I just borrow it? And he sent me pictures of his wife and his children and his mother and father-in-law putting together the puzzle as they did it. And I just find him to be a, you know, he is, I often forget because he's, you know, he stays at home with his extraordinary child and wife. And so I forget, you know, he's there. And sometimes I need him. You know, I need to think of someone like him. Mm. He's wonderful.
Yep. Absolutely agreed.
Yes.
I've just finished Orfeo, and it's phenomenal. Congratulations. Beautiful book. I think the most beautiful descriptions of music since Thomas Mann.
I can stop writing now? Is that okay?
No. Because this leads to my question. Your novels have dived into various realms of knowledge, but dived in separately. Is there a hunger in you anywhere to bring together the economic history, the racial story, the genetics, to try to actually encompass the vastness of your knowledge in a single book?
I you know that you're describing that kind of what was it, Edward Mendelsohn, the encyclopedic novel, that compulsion to try to do a grand synthesis, and I've always felt that, and you always fall short of the mark somehow. You have to somehow to get traction, you have to start filtering out, but that the novels that I most love are the ones that have striven for that kind of ultimate connectivity. It's beyond me, but I guess yes, that's the fixed star by which, you know, I would love to navigate.
I've recently realized I didn't often know that people also want to talk to me. I didn't really think that. So now, during the signing, I join the writer. So if you have questions for either of us, we'll both be out there in the lobby to meet and talk to you. The precondition, I understand, to being on the line is buying a copy of the book But I think that's reasonable. I think there should be an additional precondition, which is joining aloud or in some way or making a donation to it. Because I don't know. I think this is wonderful. I spot in the audience, I'm not going to name them, but some of the best writers in Los Angeles are here. They can pass unknown amongst us, but I'm happy to see them.
In fact, I only started to see them about 4 or 5 minutes ago. Had I seen them at the beginning, I probably would have had a hard time coming out on the stage.
Yeah. So we're grateful to you. We'll be sitting to talk to you. But remember to support your library, because it supports so many things besides ourselves. It supports the future of who we might become. And that's a really important thing. Not many things do that. So thank you very much, and we'll join you outside.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.